Well, David's new work is called Singularity. Let's talk about that. It's an amazing theory that he's put into his book. That's next on Coast to Coast AM. What's the overall theme, David, of Singularity, if you would?
Well, Singularity for me started actually, after 20 some odd years of practicing meditation daily. During the worst year of my life in 1994, I got visited by the most unbelievably, supremely beautiful, shining being of light that I'm not going to say whose name this being is, on the air, but, people will find out in the end of my book if they read it. But this being was so powerful and so bright when this being appeared to me, I fell upon my face. I could barely look upon his most supremely beautiful face. And the whole universe was manifesting out of this, who I call the supreme being. And this is where, with this being, I was taught singularity. And it took me years. In fact, Singularity as a book is really my greatest, I will call it my greatest work and my greatest achievement in my life, which I hope to be, evolving more and more as I get older.
That is huge, David, for an individual to say that about oneself. And so it really must be very important to you.
It's so important to me because what I was being taught in the presence of the Supreme Being, fallen on my face, barely able to look, thousands of times brighter than our sun, and the levels of love and ecstasy and peace and power and beauty and wisdom and graces is even brighter than the light. In fact, it's not even the light that made it so difficult to look, but actually the power and the magnitude of this being. But what started to happen was that the teachings I received in that presence, I was able to verify in, ancient spiritual manuscripts. From different religions, I could see cross-sectioning different religions that the same information was there. In fact, in Buddhism, in Hinduism, and also in mystic Christianity, in the Nag Hammadi Library, I found a wealth of information in the Gospel of Thomas. And then I started applying that to the highest ideals in quantum physics to solve the three great, what I call the three great inertias. And those three great inertias are, the first is the psychological inertia over the knowledge of good and evil, which is the root cause of inner conflict, depression, separating us from the whole, the one, the unenlightened state of mind that leads to war, genocide, and other terrifying corruptions, which we're all facing on this planet right now, and you were talking about that earlier. The second inertia is the inertia of movement, and this one's really interesting because in the Nag Hammadi Library, which is, of course, where Dan Brown's, many of his source material comes from, in what's called the trimorphic protonoia, there's the most profound, simple sentence that I just meditate on. I mean, it's like a Zen koan to me. It says that humanity, after the fall, being cast out of the Garden of Eden, we were cast down to the lowest region of all matter in the universe. And it doesn't say geographically the lowest region of the universe. It says the lowest region of all matter. So I often wonder if that code, that actual code that is on matter, which I will demonstrate, prevents us from even seeing other intelligent and even biological beings that may be living on our other nine planets and other planets in our own galaxy. The very fact that NASA can't find other intelligent life in the universe may be because of this code that our matter is actually coded with, which I'll demonstrate. The third inertia is the inertia of disease, death, and the actual physical,
like the aging process.
The aging process, disease, death, and how we actually die. I mean, we only live for 100 years. A good man will live 100 years if he's lucky. And it's kind of like that same time clock. You have 100 years to make your mark, to do something with your life, to experience this thing before the great mystery reveals itself to you again. So for me, those three problems are the greatest problems that human beings face. The fact that we die, the fact that we can't move anywhere, that matter as it is, according to Einstein's law, matter in its current state, I rephrase, cannot move faster than the speed of light. And the speed of light is not fast enough to get anywhere in this universe. I mean, God gave us a really tough problem here. And then, of course, the first one and the great one is war. You know, why do all the religions fight? And I was actually in the presence of this being receiving the teachings that could answer all of these. But it's taken me years. That was in 1994 to actually, you know, in a game of chess, prove it to people. And the only way I could prove it is compare the spiritual models with models in quantum physics. So I started with, and we've, you know, just as a brief overview, we've done the three great inertias in the shows before, and this is very detailed in my book, which is now available. The first inertia I call the psychological inertia, which is over the knowledge of good and evil. When Adam and Eve were in the Garden of Eden, they were in paradise. They originally lived in singularity or oneness, and God warned them, never partake of the knowledge of good and evil, for in the day you do, you will surely die. It doesn't say God will kill them, that God will do anything horrible to them. It says you will die. And that death is actually what I can actually demonstrate. I can actually demonstrate how that happens after we partake of this knowledge of good and evil. In fact, in the Nag Hammadi Library, Trimorphic Protonoia, there are clear statements contradictory to most theological views that the knowledge of good and evil represents chaos. It represents conflict. If you see in your mind right now, if we ingest the knowledge of good and evil, what we're ingesting is a conflict. So going from a state of innocence or enlightenment or oneness, once you ingest conflict is, it cannot survive in a state of love. A state of love is peaceful. It's a state of union where there's no conflict. That is what love is. That is what peace is. So conflict can't exist in peace, so it falls into a lower dimension where it works itself out. Now, when 8 billion people take in the knowledge of good and evil, they identify good and evil egotistically for themselves alone. And when they compare it with their neighbor, of course, they find out we disagree. In fact, rarely do we ever agree 100% on anything. In fact, everybody has a different viewpoint about everything. But some of us generally agree, so we agree to form, you know, corporations, businesses, relationships, and then religions. And even a single religion becomes divided hundreds and hundreds of times, and actually documented Christianity, Buddhism, Hinduism, and, you know, Judaism, all of the great religions are divided in more than 100 times. And in fact, Jesus says in the Gospels that how can Satan's kingdom stand and survive if it is divided? So what this does is, because we absolutely believe that our interpretation of our own religion is correct and the other wrong, we actually get into this trap, this game. We believe it so strongly, we hold it against the other. We even tell our son and our daughter that you can't marry a person who disagrees with our family religion. Mm-hmm. And, you know, meanwhile, the son or the daughter is in love and they want to fall in love with this person and marry them, and the parents, you know, protest. And this is the beginning of the starvation of love in the soul. Because we're not experiencing union, love, we're in this state of conflict. We starve. I actually saw this in the presence of this supreme being, that the duality of good and evil produces a oval or egg-shaped force field around the human soul, and it shields out the omnipresent singularity of the oneness of God. And so we don't experience that connectedness anymore. So ultimately, what happens is, of course, we get wars. The ultimate end game for the inner conflict is we take our viewpoint, our fanatical viewpoint of our religion, so seriously, we believe that we're superior to the other, including inside of our own religion. I mean, we know in the Middle East, even most recently, that Saddam Hussein killed Muslims. I mean, they were actually the Shiites and the Sunnis, and I mean, they're all fighting each other. And the same thing has happened historically with Christianity and many other world religions. So we're all guilty of this. We've all taken on that egotistical role of saying that, you know, our view is more superior than the other. So that's the first inertia, which is psychological inertia, and which the end game ultimately is genocide. And that's where we're about to face on this planet today.
And it could be total mass genocide.
It could be total mass genocide. And the idea of the absolute oneness, when the Muslims say that there's only one true God, that one true God is pure oneness. It's not, we egofy, we identify God as the ego. When Jesus said, only by me shall you enter the kingdom of heaven, when he's saying me, it's not the same as when we say me. We say me as an ego. But when Jesus says I, his I is the whole universe. And it's total love for the whole universe and everything in it. So he's saying only by total love for the whole universe, which is the truth of who he is, shall you enter the kingdom of God. But because we personify that as the egos, we take it against the other. Even, you know, in fact, my family's Catholic. And, you know, Catholics are told that by other even fanatical, other Christian groups that they're going to go to hell. And Catholics believe the same thing about other sects of Christianity. So the madness goes on. Now, what gets really interesting is when we look at this knowledge of good and evil, this duality, and we look at how consciousness may be affecting reality. We look at the atom itself. We all know from the movie What the Bleep Do We Know, from Dr. Emoto's studies on water, that thought can cause water, which is made of very simple hydrogen and oxygen atoms, some of the most simple atoms in the periodic elements scale, that your thoughts can tell the atoms in the water what to do. You know, if you think a loving thought, and you freeze the water, Dr. Emoto's photos show these beautiful crystalline structures. If you think hatred, I hate you thoughts, then the water crystal, the frozen crystals are all chaotic and messed up. Well, if you go even further back to Clive Baxter's work in The Secret Life of Plants in the 1970s, he proved this concept much further back in history, that consciousness was affecting reality, that plants, when hooked up to EEG sensors, could feel our vibrations and our thoughts, and they registered on polygraphs that thought transferred into living organic material. So when we look at the atom, and what we're going to see is the exact same duality, the same pairedness, the same chaos that is in consciousness itself. When we look at the atom, we see that the atom is made of a proton and an electron. A proton is positive charged and the electron is negative charged. And then when we zoom in on the electron, we find out the electron has an anti-electron. So you have electron negative, anti-electron positive. Then when you look at the proton, which is where most of the mass energy in the atom is, it has an antiproton. And then when you go deeper into the proton, you find that the proton is made up of quarks, and quarks are all divided in dual pairs. In fact, everywhere you go into subatomic particles, you see the same duality. So the big question comes, is consciousness telling the atom what to do? Is it keeping the atom in this state? And is that code, the code that the trimorphic protonoia states in the Nag Hammadi Library, that humanity was cast to the lowest region of all matter? And what we find in that code, I mean, I'm just kind of briefly going through an overview.
No, I understand.
That the reason mass, spaceship, pilot cannot go faster than the speed of light is because of inertia. Inertia is the tendency of a body to resist acceleration. And you end up finding out that the root cause of the second inertia, the fact that we can't move faster than the speed of light, is the dual pairedness on matter itself. And in fact, the way to demonstrate this, it's really quite simple. The model that I'll give the audience is that first, look at how humanity has evolved in just travel. First, we took horses and animals and we walked or moved across the landscape in buggies and horses and walking and running. And that method of travel was very, very slow and very cumbersome. And then we invented boats, and we started moving through the oceans and lakes. When a boat moves through a body of water, the propeller, which is the propulsion system on the boat, has to spin faster in order for the boat to go faster. But as the boat moves, just like if you stand in a swimming pool and you try to run in the water, you push against the water. That's the tendency of your body to resist acceleration because of the strata, the water that you're moving through. You can't go very fast through water. It takes months to cross the Atlantic. You know, when Columbus discovered America, in 1492, he it took him months and months to get across the Atlantic. Well, finally, we find, the birth of air flight, with the Wright brothers in Kitty Hawk in North Carolina. We find that if you fly through air mass, which is a finer strata to move through in propulsion, you can go a lot faster. You can cross the Atlantic in hours instead of months. And that resistance, that inertia, is less because the strata that you're moving through is much more, it's less dense. So, but what the problem with aircraft is, the faster you go, the more that wind, that inertia, pushes on the aircraft, making it heavier in relationship to the wind. So you have to apply greater and greater force and propulsion, and eventually the craft starts to become unstable. It starts to heat up, just like the space shuttle does when it enters that dense atmosphere.
And disintegrates.
And it disintegrates. So there's a limitation on how fast you can go, and right now we can go up to almost Mach 10. You know, NASA has this little... you know, X model aircraft that's unmanned that can go nearly, it's like Mach 9.6. So now when you go in space, you're going into yet another finer strata. In fact, when we go into space, we think, well, it's a void. In fact, Einstein originally thought it was a void, space was a void. And in fact, he thought, ultimately, people thought if you went into space, you could travel in unlimited speeds. And very quickly, Einstein found out that his law was correct. Even in space, the limit was just under the speed of light for mass. You could not actually attain the speed of light, and that is correct to this day. Because the faster you go, ultimately, you can go a lot faster. The space shuttle does 90-minute orbits, an hour and a half. It makes an orbit around the whole planet, which is much faster.
Can you believe that?
Isn't that incredible? 90 minutes.
It really
an hour
is.
And a half. Now, when you get frustrated with the problems of inertia in space, you find out that the aircraft or the spacecraft is pushing on the background of space, making it heavier. You can slowly accelerate up to, you know, nearly, if you have it really, you know, powerful nuclear drive systems, ion drive systems, you can get up to 1/10 the speed of light, which is 67 million miles per hour. But then as soon as you want to turn out of the way to avoid an asteroid or any incoming debris, the G-forces on the turn are going to kill you, and they're going to destroy your craft. And ultimately, you're going to have to turn to avoid something, especially when you get out to the asteroid belt, and then which is beyond the solar system, and then you get to the Oort cloud, which is where all the comets are, the ice comets are, which is even a bigger problem than the asteroid belt in the far reaches of the solar system. There's no way you can accelerate towards the speed of light because you're going to hit something. And then the G-forces on the turns at those velocities are going to destroy you. So when you find out that that is a problem, you find out, okay, what is the next strata? Where can you got to get out of space to move faster than the speed of light. It's kind of like, how do you get out of space? You know, where's this next evolution? And that's where the doorway opens to singularity. When you finally get frustrated with this enemy called inertia, and you look at these different strata, you find out, you know, even with wormholes is almost ridiculous to me. I mean, the idea that people win great physics prizes for these things, instead of sending a spacecraft or a pilot between two distant locations, you want to move the location itself, and you want to fold the fabric of space and time, all that mass, and bend it, so that it's so close to each other, then you create a shortcut wormhole to vector in between those two points.
It sounds good, David.
It sounds good on paper, but it's unattainable. And the fact that we spend so much energy focusing on something that requires the negative energy of 100 million suns for a total year, and we can't even, none of our fissible nuclear fuels on this planet can ever produce energy levels, not even a thousandth or a millionth of that, is ludicrous physics. So you have to ultimately wonder how they're doing it. And I remember once when I was in Maui in the year 2000, right up in the sky, I was sitting in the back of this truck, and we were talking, me and this woman were talking about UFOs, and lo and behold, you look up in the sky and you see this boom, boom. Like it seemed like in the same second there was a ball of light here, and all of a sudden it was 10 miles away in the same second. It was like a pulse. Now, that object did not appear to pass through the intervening space between the two points. Now, if I were a fish under the water and I saw a boat sitting on the top of the water, it would make an indentation into my strata, my sphere, which is water. And yet that little bubble, that boat, would lift up in the air and travel through the air mass. I wouldn't see it traveling up in the sky. Then it would set itself back down on the water. I would see it indent the water in that same way, but I would not see it passing through the water, which is my strata. I think the same thing happened when I saw this UFO jump between those two points. It did not, it got out of what we call space.
So when we come back, tell us how we can get there, David. We'll be back. Okay, we'll take your phone calls next hour with David Sirita. But I'll be back with him as we continue to talk about singularity on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, David Sirita, our guest. David, propulsion then, in the light that you saw, what could have been a craft, how it originated from one point, got to another in the bat of an eye, how does this happen?
Well, see, in order to understand how, firstly, I demonstrate, you know, how inertia, you know, prevents the acceleration of an object in the three major strata that we know, which is water, air, and space. Those are the only three that we know so far. And that you really have to understand, you know, in fact, what I'm going to do different this time than the other times we talked about this is we're going to go to the Big Bang and apply singularity to it. In fact, Stephen Hawking wrote that the actual point of creation lies outside the scope of presently known laws of physics. And a less well-known but very distinguished cosmologist, Professor Alan Guth from MIT, says, quote, the instant of creation remains unexplained. In fact, what singularity is going to do is describe that instant, and you're going to see the birth of these strata. And to understand the birth of them in a brief synopsis, which is massively detailed in my book, you'll understand why we can't move and then where we can move instantaneously anywhere in the universe. In fact, when I think about the idea, and this is very new, a very new thought I'm having right now, is that if consciousness is so powerful that it can tell the atom what to do, you know, to remain in this dual pairedness, and this duality of good and evil and positive, negative charges on the subatomic particles,
right,
is the cause of inertia. How powerful that mind is that ultimately the atom says that I can give birth to life, create stars and planets, but I can also produce a nuclear weapon. That power in the atom is that great that it can produce the end game, which is genocide. What would the atom do if we knew how to tell it a different message?
Well, here's the point, though, David. Are we, let's use this little atom as an example. Mm-hmm. Does it have free will? I don't think so. If the message is do it, it's done.
Well, actually, you know, you get into, like, Edgar Mitchell's, he calls it the quantum hologram. In fact, I was having this conversation with an amazing conflict strategist and therapist. Her name is Bree Wilson in Vancouver, Canada, and she has these, you know, transcendent guides that she communicates with, and she's going into these quantum physics discussions with them, and she invited, you know, me to talk to her about my work. And one of the things I realized right away is that atoms, this is a simple model of a Niels Bohr's hydrogen atom. When an atom's the electron orbit around the proton shortens its wavelength, the atom radiates off photons. And when it increases its wavelength, which means it's jumping shells, it receives photonic energy. In fact, it's an exchange. And I always knew and believed that that exchange involved intelligent information, that atoms were exchanging information, just like, for example, right now we're talking on the radio all over the world. We're sending information, voices, on light waves, which are called radio waves, which travel at the speed of light all over the world. And we can also send pictures, television, on which those images are carried on light waves, on microwaves, which is where television is broadcasting. So the idea that atoms could exchange intelligent information was, according to Edgar Mitchell, was actually proven very recently by this physicist Walter Schempp. In fact, it's a really fascinating lecture that Astron Edgar Mitchell discusses, where he proves that the atom is actually conscious. But the problem is, because the atom is dual-paired and it's sending information at the speed of light, and the speed of light is only 186,282 miles per second, which comes to 670 million miles an hour, that is not instant. In fact, when we look at light from the Andromeda galaxy, we're seeing it as it was 2.2 million years ago. We're not seeing our universe in real time. Light is giving us an illusion, a false picture. So the only way to really understand why all of this is, why we're trapped in this maya, this illusion that, and light is playing this game on us that says that you can't move faster than me and I'm your only detection device. You know, relativity relies on the speed of light and light to detect all events in the known universe. We're really kind of trapped. So we have to look at this problem of this instant character that no one can explain. And so it was really Paul Dirac originally who discovered what I'm calling singularity. In fact, it was an accident the way he discovered it. But Dirac actually sees the birth of matter. In fact, I've never heard in the quantum physics world anyone who has actually witnessed the birth of matter and how matter is born from ultra-high frequency gamma waves, which are the highest frequency light waves, which give birth to electron-anti-electron pairs. So you're going from light actually as we know it, as we know it is a singularity. It moves. In fact, Jesus said in the Gospel of Matthew 6:22, if thine eye be single, thy whole body shall be filled with light. Well, it turns out that light has no dual pair inside of it. It spins positive. It propagates along in a wave at the speed of light, but its spin speed is much faster. But light, because it's not traveling instantaneously, is obviously encountering inertia. In fact, when light moves through water, which is one of our three major strata, it slows down, which shows you that water is pushing on it, just like it pushes on our own body as we try to move through water. And that now you have this Einstein-Bose condensate, which takes hydrogen atoms and cools them down to what's called absolute zero, which is, you know, minus 400-something degrees Fahrenheit. I mean, it's colder than space, than the background of space, which is minus 273 degrees. And as light propagates through this Einstein-Bose condensate, it travels at zero velocity. It slows down to zero. And just recently, they found that light is going in negative time. So you're actually finding out that light is trapped in the same duality. So what's pushing upon light? Why can't it move instantly anywhere in the universe? Well, it turns out that this strata, the third strata called space, the background of space, dark matter, is producing negative pressure. And because in a duality, negative and positive are attracted to each other, they put pressure on each other. In the atom itself, the play between the electron and the proton, most physicists think that conflict literally destroys, it cancels out all the energy in the atom. The overall energy and force in the atom is defeated in that conflict.
Do you agree with that?
No. I believe that there's what is called differentials, which gets into a much more complicated thing. Because, for example, this is where I think the missing particle in physics, the graviton, is. The very fact that we're standing on this Earth right now, and you're in St. Louis and I'm in Los Angeles, and there are two forces at play in this planet. This planet is spinning at 1,000 miles an hour at the equator, like a washing machine. We should be thrown and hurled out into space, but we're not. There's another force, centripetal force, which is pulling in, that is competing with that force, and what we experience of gravity is the leftover or differential between those two forces. And if only one of them was at play, just the pulling in force, we would be crushed. We'd be so heavy we couldn't stand up. And if the throwing out force was the only force, we'd be thrown off the planet and none of us would even be here. So the very fact that there's a differential between those two forces, I believe, and I can actually prove this, this is actually proved in my book, Singularity, in actual wave models, that there is a differential leftover between electron-anti-electron pairs, proton-antiproton pairs, and the differential between the proton-antiproton competes with the differential of the electron-anti-electron. And those differentials,
what did you missed me on that one. Slow down and tell me that again.
Okay, so the differential between the competition between the electron-anti-electron, that competition, just like two people pulling on a rope in opposite directions.
Okay, I understand that.
One of them is slightly greater than the other. And that leftover force moves either forward or backwards, which then meets up with the leftover competition energy between the proton and antiproton, and those two compete with each other. And that's where I think gravity actually is. Because in the quantum world, the atom is smaller. I believe that force is reflecting out into what we call the astrophysical model, which is gravity as I just demonstrated. It's a competition between two forces, but the competition doesn't end at zero. If the competition between centrifugal, spinning outward, and centripetal, pulling in, was zero, we wouldn't have any weight. In fact, we wouldn't even be standing on the Earth. Everything would just be canceled out to a dead zero. There wouldn't be this pull that's holding us on the Earth. So that's when you get into something called differentials, which is very interesting and detailed in my book. But what happens is, as these forces compete with each other and compete with each other, you get inertia slows things down more and more and more. So what we do is we take singularity, this force that Paul Dirac discovered. He sees the birth of electron-anti-electron pairs, and then in bubble chambers, in spark chambers, where they measure the trails that subatomic particles leave in these vapor trails. It's kind of like throwing a rock through fog or a cloud. It leaves a trail, and they photograph the trail. Well, when they're actually, they strip an electron-anti-electron dual pair off of a proton, they see it spins into smaller and smaller diameter or radial distance orbits, which means its wavelength is shortening. Paul Dirac actually calculates the exact moment that the electron, which is the lowest mass particle we know of, it gives up all of its, when its wavelength shortens, we know from Niels Bohr's atom that it radiates off its energy. In an Einstein equation, energy and mass are equivalent, so it's giving up its mass-energy equivalent. When it reaches zero, when it gives up all of its mass-energy, you can't see it anymore. And traditional physicists thought, oh my God, they must have crashed into each other and annihilated. And Dirac said, no way. If they did that, there would have been an explosion. Matter and antimatter would have collided. And there was no explosion in the bubble chambers. So they disagreed with him. He said they simply went into a higher frequency state, attained zero mass, which proves that mass can attain zero mass. And because mass and gravity are also in the same relationship as energy and mass, mass and gravity are proportional, you're reducing your mass-gravity effect to zero in your electron, which means you can attain zero mass, which is what I believe these spacecraft are actually doing. When you look at what spacecrafts are made out of in pilots, it's just, at the atomic level, it's just particles and waves.
Well, are they traveling, though, David, or just appearing?
Well, it's only an appearance, and I'll explain to you why. If we take the Big Bang and we're looking for what Alan Guth calls that instant character that no one can explain, and what Dirac says is when you enter this single sea where there's no duality, this sea will not allow this substratum to our whole universe. He defines as absolute negative, which I determine is a mistake as a term, not as a reality, but as a term. This negative, Dirac says, will not allow a dual pair in it. It will spit it out. It won't allow it to exist. But what he discovered was that as soon as you enter this sea, you have to become one with it. You can't be a duality and enter the single sea. And if you become one with it and enter it, you're everywhere in the universe at the same time. In fact, there is no inertia. There's no friction because there's no positive and negative. That means you can be anywhere in the universe in zero time. In fact, you're omnipresent. You're all-knowing. In fact, at that point, you're so baffled, you don't even want to move because you're already everywhere in the universe there is anyway. So the question is, how do you move from here to Andromeda? How do you move from here to another star system? And how is that instantly moved? They're not actually moving through space, and I'll show you when we see the birth of the three strata.
All right.
What happens is, that at the instant of creation, you have all of your values. Time has a value of zero because if there's no inertia and you can be anywhere in zero time, your time value is zero in this infinitely, you know, bigger than the universe we know of, strata. And then your space, which is your X, Y, Z, which is height, width, and length, or depth, those X, Y, Z coordinates have values of absolute zero because space is an illusion caused by the idea that you have to move through it in what a factor of time. Time is Einstein's fourth dimension. Now, in a singularity, as soon as a duality exists, just like we're going back to the Garden of Eden, as soon as you go from a state of love, a state of union where there's no conflict, and you introduce conflict, duality, it spits it out. It falls to a lower level because a conflict can't survive in love. So that imagine that infinitum of energy in the singularity, which is not really energy as we know it today. And as soon as the first dual pair is formed, what happens is this. You have two, a positive and negative wave with an enormous, enormous clash. And as those two waves crash into each other, the temperature is so massive, which according to traditional theory today, at the moment of the Big Bang, and this is the new instant character that nobody knows where it is, the temperature was I think it was 100 billion degrees. I think that's
Oh, my.
So you look at the temperature of the universe at the moment of the Big Bang, 100,000 second after the Big Bang, you get a temperature of 100 degrees, 100 billion Kelvin, and a density a billion times greater than water. So as soon as you have duality, you have a strata, you have a fabric being formed, and time value, because now you have inertia. As soon as you have friction, your inertia is your first force is duality. Your second force is inertia, which is resistance. And because there's resistance to move, your time value goes from zero, and it starts increasing. And as it increases, the universe more and more waves after the first two waves crash together. They create shock waves, and those waves crash into each other, which produces more and more resistance, which means time value is now increasing. So the universe gives the illusion that it's expanding over a period of time. So what singularity says is that the universe was pre-existently infinite. It never was not infinite. In fact, it was already pre-expansive. And this explains, according to Dirac, why the cosmic microwave background radiation is evenly distributed rather than a gradient temperature from hot to cold, which would, over a period of time, the background of space should be cooling down. But as the universe expands, that cooling curve should go from hot to cold, and it doesn't. The background temperature is even. So singularity answers that. So what happens is as more and more dual waves are crashing into each other, the soup of the background of space is getting thicker. And that's the stuff you have to move through when you want to move from one point to another. But when you move through a dual paired billions and trillions of atoms, they're going to push on you and slow you down.
How do you then make this happen?
How you make it happen is it's about transformation. It's about, ultimately, I believe that UFOs were building wave generators, the most advanced civilizations, which are ultimately the highest spiritually evolved beings, that transform their mass into singularity, and they enter the singularity field, and they're all-knowing. They're everywhere in the universe. In fact, at this point, you've proven the existence of God, the great, what Jesus constantly refers to in the Gospel of Thomas, which we went over in the last show, that if you make the two one and you tell the mountain to move, it will move. He's telling you how you can move a whole mountain is by, you know, telling the atoms to become single. You know, when you make the two one. And in fact, Jesus says in the Gospel of Thomas, on the day that you were one, you were in the light. And then when you became two, what will you do? He's actually telling you the process of singularity, going from singularity to duality. He knows that as soon as you become a dual-paired being, you're going to experience death, because the cells in your body, in the third inertia, are also trapped in that same duality. In fact, when you look at the double helix of DNA, you see the ultimate fabric, the dual-paired fabric of our DNA, which causes the cells in our body to be fighting each other.
You know, David, I feel like I'm talking to the modern-day Carl Jung. I mean, really, I have that approach. Has anybody ever tied you in with him?
Well, actually, yeah, my father, who got his PhD in Berkeley in the 60s, was a big, you know, Jungian, you know, student. And to me, you know, this is, like I said, this is the greatest work that I will ever contribute to. I'm relying on all the great physicists of our time, but this supremely enlightened being who was standing before me was teaching me this. And I had to put it in a form to answer the three great inertia.
I know it's a tough topic for people to grasp, but you're doing a good job, I think, explaining it.
So now when you see in the Big Bang how the universe developed the three strata and you find your way back to singularity, ultimately, if you can wave transform the atoms in your spaceship and your pilot to singularity and enter it, you can go anywhere in the universe in zero time. In fact, light as we know it is part of the illusion. Light was created after inertia. You have inertia, friction, heat, and then light is born, which illuminates the duality.
So all right, stay with us, David. Let's take phone calls when we come back on Coast to Coast AM. Open the lines.